Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Greta Anderson, together with my guest co-host, Emma Wilson. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Emma grew up in Nevada and is now attending Drake University and is focusing on Arabic language, Middle Eastern politics, and broadcast journalism there. She visited Egypt last year as part of the Model Arab League and will be revisiting it this year through the same program. That background definitely caused her to key into our first guest, who not only witnessed the Arab Spring in Cairo's Tahrir Square, but was one of the young people who brought that moment into being. Issam Boré is now living in central Iowa. We'll tell you why in a minute.
Meanwhile, in Egypt, continues to be in the news. Just over the weekend, it was reported that the new president, al-Sisi, who was put into power by the military in a fraudulent election, fired his entire cabinet. And the first parliamentary elections since 2012 are scheduled for November, which is when I will be back in Egypt for Model Arab League.
Looking ahead to later in the show, we'll be bringing you some reporting from the Story County GOP tailgate tent at Saturday's Cyclone Hawkeye game. Several Republican presidential candidates were at the game, and so was a group of students protesting what they call the hate speech of one of those candidates.
And then, of course, there are the protesters of the protesters.
All that and more. But let's welcome to today's show Issam Boré of Cairo, Egypt. Welcome, Issam.
Thank you so much.
As it so happens, we owe Issam's presence in Iowa to presidential politics, as he got a job working with the Bernie Sanders campaign before deciding that politics was a poor substitute for his main calling, human rights advocacy. And Issam, that is the role you had in early 2011 when demonstrations broke out in Cairo's Tahrir Square and the 30-year reign of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was ended, correct?
Yes, actually, I've started my work for human rights at 2009 in Egypt.
So not only did Issam witness firsthand the government's crackdown on demonstrations in Tahrir Square, but he also witnessed U.S. diplomatic response, and he'll share his stories of his meetings with Hillary Clinton and John Kerry later on in the show.
So, Issam, can you set the scene for us of the Arab Spring? What were you doing and thinking in the days leading up to these historic demonstrations?
Well, the whole story started when we had a new generation with this new big changes in the whole world. It was the social media and this kind of the whole change that the whole world witnessed in this time. And in this time we had in Egypt like something called You Can't Dream, which is the dream was forbidden this time in Egypt. Or at least if you would like to have a dream, you have to dream according to the government textbook. They will give you a textbook to tell you how to dream or what your dream should be. So we had that dream to see our country or the whole Middle East is a better place to live in. We just decided to have to dream for our future and our kids' future, our grandkids' future.
Connecting through social media.
Through social media. Yeah, yes. We start all of our protests, all of our movements through the social media, Facebook, Twitter. And I remember in very, very beginning of our demonstration, the whole Arab Spring time, the people used to say how this Facebook generation will never change anything. They had this idea, and social media was a huge thing in our movement, and we used to connect ourselves through the social media. We went in the street with this big dream to having a good life in Egypt and the whole Middle East, which is our regime didn't want us to have this, but we just fought against our regime, and we won at the end of the day. But our winning didn't continue with us for that much long because lots of mistakes from us in the very first place and other people in second place.
Can you tell us more about what does Tahrir Square look like? How many people were in the street, and what kind of signs were they carrying? Who was speaking?
Tahrir Square, it's a huge, the biggest square in downtown Cairo, Egypt. We start our demonstration January 25th, 2011. We started as like few of hundreds of people, starting our protest in front of the Supreme Court in downtown Egypt. And we started inviting people using social media and the other tools that we had in this time to call people just join us in our demonstration. We are running for very few rights for everyone, which was dignity, freedom, and a good life for everyone. Dignity, justice, and freedom. So we start from downtown in front of this in the Supreme Court in Egypt, and we move to Tahrir Square, which is like 5 minutes walking distance from the Supreme Court in downtown. We ended up our 18 days against the Mubarak regime, where we used to be more than 3 million people in the street, but the whole in the Tahrir Square. But in this time, every single city in Egypt had its own Tahrir Square. We used to call it Tahrir Square everywhere, even if this place, of course, we just have one only Tahrir Square in Egypt, downtown Cairo, but we called in every single square in every single city in Egypt, Tahrir Square, referring it to the main idea of Tahrir Square. We were very young people. Our ages used to be in mid-20s. We start this protesting was like 5 people 3 years before our revolution. And in our revolution, we reached the number was like 30 million according to the some accountability people say, okay, it was like 30 million people in the street after 3 years working in the street, trying to networking with people in the street and asking them to join us January 25th. Through 18 days, we reached 30 million people against Mubarak regime, and we were protesting, as I said, for just three words, no more: freedom, justice, and
dignity.
That's all what we had. We for these three words, we lost our friends, our loved ones, many times, and it was very bad times for every one of us at this time. But after the 18 days, and still very, very, I feel like very emotional in this time. Every time I remember what happened in Tahrir Square.
So, did you see the regime coming back at protesters in the streets physically? Did you see people being hurt by the regime?
Yeah, actually, I saw my friend killed next to me. Like it was, as I used to say, it's like some of my friends was right next to me and they died. And I remember if like the bullet just moved 1 centimeter in any other direction, it should be me who murdered now, and I couldn't be with you. So yeah, it's like the regime in this time used every single power tool he had to just to prevent our revolution to be succeeded. And we fought back against this, and we saw people murdered in the street, people get killed by snipers, by the regime snipers, of course. They killed lots of people. I remember very well how much blood we saw in the streets, and our friends and loved one who was always talking to us that we paid our blood just for this, like to keep this going on. And we couldn't leave the square without continue what we've started for at least for our future and for our friends. They just died for like 5 minutes in this time. So yeah, we witnessed everything. We saw people died. We saw people killed in the street. We saw our friends' blood in the street. And they used tear gas against us. They used bullets against us. They had snipered in the building around Tahrir Square to prevent this revolution to be succeeded. But we won by the end of the day. So it was very hard times. Sorry.
Well, the thought that runs through my mind, Emma, is that our our government is supplying some of these arms that
right.
that did this.
Mm-hmm.
And Issam, it's been very tumultuous throughout several years in Egypt. What has happened to you personally as this has gone on? Were you arrested? Were you put into prison because of your work for human rights?
I've started my work for human rights since 2009, and we get arrested many times because we used to protest against the regime. It's before the before our revolution. It's through 2009 and 2010. I get arrested more than two or three times for my working for human rights and not only for my human rights working, but also for protesting against the regime for different we protest against the regime. We protest against the bad constitution that we had in this time, and we protested for our rights that the regime used to like didn't care anything about our rights in this time, our human rights, freedom of speech, our freedom of religion, freedom of beliefs, everything. It used to be controlled by the regime. But through the revolution, they tried to kill us, but the rest of us who survived, I guess I was lucky that I survived through our revolution. But they changed the strategy with my work. After the revolution, I had this, idea, which is now we are in the new Egypt and new era, and we can continue working very freely for the human rights and advocate for human rights in Egypt. And we had big hope to improve our work for Egypt. But in this time, they changed the strategy, and they sent us to the criminal, sent me with among of other friends. We used all of us work for human rights in Egypt. They sent us to the criminal court for our work for human rights. Literally, our charge was working for a human rights organization and taking money from a foreign government to divide Egypt into four countries. It seems very stupid, but this is what happened. But we, on the other side, we had another battle, which was in the media or the public opinion. And this is how the any country run by dictatorship. This is the way they usually give you very stupid charges in any criminal court or anything, and they start making a big issue through the media. So our charge in the media was we were the spies, we were the people who betrayed the country for the CIA and the foreign intelligence agencies. And everyone in Egypt, every single Egyptian person, he didn't believe that we just in the criminal court because of working for a human rights organization. Every single one used to look at us as the people who betrayed the country. I had through my trial, my last trial, I had to change my house many times. I used to move around Egypt many times just to stop talking about that I'm the spy, and people used to harass him, like to act very bad with me, because they always like 24-hour talking in the media about how we betrayed our country, and also. We didn't know that much about our trial through the regular basis, the legal regular basis. We used to know our everything, like get updating about our trial through the media. Mm. So we knew about our trial through the media first. Then the court sent us a notification that we should show up in the courtroom, blah, blah, blah. And then we knew the names in the trial through the media. And it was like the first time it happens that the judge himself, he went to the TV station and he made a press statement against us. And he said, hey, those are people who betrayed the country. It was very weird that to see a judge instead of the courtroom and the TV screen, and instead of arguing with your lawyers and with you and your case, he just give his verdict online. So, I'm sorry, on air. It seems now very funny, but and
surreal is the word.
It's real. That's really what happened. We really knew everything of our trial and about Egypt and the TV.
This is Local Talk, and we are talking with someone who has relocated to Des Moines, central Iowa, after having participated in the Arab Spring in Cairo. Issam Boré, a human rights advocate, saw firsthand the demonstrations in the street and some of the crackdown by the government.
So while you were in prison, I know you had some interactions with the U.S. government. Can you describe a little bit what you experienced in terms of the U.S. response to the military crackdown in Egypt and the U.S. response to the revolution?
Well, let me say this: in the very beginning of our revolution, we didn't have anything to say. This thing is gonna support our revolution because we didn't have the big dream of revolution. But once we went in the street and we found our movement is growing up, and it will be a huge issue, we were so comfortable that the USA will never let someone kill us in the street. Especially our regime used to kill us in the daylight in the streets in front of the cameras, and everyone saw us dying in the street. And the first response was very disappointed, which is this time the American administration, they said, like, we trust in the Egyptian president, which was very disappointed, that we used to believe in, but this is the truth now in Egypt. We used to believe that the American administration always stands for the American values, which is everyone still believe in. But the first response was, we trust in the Egyptian president, which is you're seeing by your eyes now the Egyptian president is killing his people in the street in daylight, killing young people and 20s just in a peaceful protesting in Egypt, saying just three words, dignity, freedom, and justice. And you kill these people. And the American administration said, we trust in this president. So you trust him for more kill? Or I didn't understand in this time. After this, I had some of the American officials came to Egypt just to listen after our revolution, after our president ousted in Egypt, Hosni Mubarak. They came many times just to know more about the new situation. How can we help? What should we do for you? And of course, we had this talk many times, and nothing happened. Literally nothing happened, and this was the second disappointment the American administration through the Arab Spring movements. The third one, and through my last trial in Egypt for human rights. In this time I used to work for American human rights organizations. I was in the criminal court because of my work for human rights. And it was everyone in the whole world was talking about our trial. It was very obvious that it's unbelievable to send very young people to the criminal court, not only a regular court, just because they used to work for a human rights organization. So the whole world was talking about us. We're talking about our trial. And in this time, still the American administration didn't do anything, and they keep saying that we trust in the Egyptian regime. Even in this time, they said this not only for the, they said for the same thing for Mubarak when he was in power. Mm-hmm. He was killing us in the street, and when he gone, and this scav, the military leaders running Egypt in this time through our trial, they said the same. So I really didn't understand, like, they trust in every single regime who comes to kill people.
Right.
But so, like, we have very different issues. If we can understand in the revolution that it's like the first day for young people who run in the street, And you need, you have some interest with this regime, and you need to support your aliens in the Middle East. But with the other young people who are in the criminal court for working for human rights, so what? Why you like taking the other side? It's like right. It's very obvious that, and the case it was very famous, and very clear for everyone that just. Political trial for young people who had a dream for a better country. So through the Arab Spring movements and what happened after this, it was very disappointing that what we heard from the American administration.
Yeah. So just to kind of bring people up to speed here a little bit, Egypt has been through several changes in the past few years. After Hosni Mubarak fell, the country held its first democratic elections, in which Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood was elected. And he was in office just less than a year before public protests calling for his ousting were followed by a military coup in June of 2013. And then in a military controlled election, which was held about a year later, the new military leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi won 96% of the vote there. So Issam, looking back at the turn of events here and forward to the parliamentary elections this fall, what kind of final thoughts would you like to share about the situation here?
I hate to say this, but it's the image is very dark now in Egypt, which is the 30 million people who run in the streets, they ran behind an idea. And the people who created this idea or who led this idea, now they divided into three categories. The first categories are murdered in the streets. Really, it was a very, very strong message for the rest of the 30 million people, just to stay home or you will be murdered. The second category, they're imprisoned. Now we have almost 50,000 people in the prison now, with no trials, with no charges in Egypt,
and no pressure from the U.S. State Department to
they still trust in the Egyptian regime. So of course the international human rights organizations talking too much about this, and we're still talking about this. So the most people who are taking lead through the our democracy ideas, murdered or imprisoned or lives in exile just like me. The rest of it, I think these are so very strong message for every single one, just to stay home, or you have just three scenarios. You have like three options. you choose one. If you'd like to run for these ideas, you have three scenarios. You can choose one of them. So I can say the image in Egypt is so dark, and we need everyone who believes in democracy, who believes in a better future for the whole world, not only for the Middle East, because we believe very well that everything happened in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, it affects the whole world, not only affected the place that happened in. So yeah, the photo is very dark, and we need everyone together for these ideas to have a better future for the whole world.
Well, very well put. Thank you very much, Issam Boré, for coming all the way up from Des Moines to join us this morning. And thank you, Emma, for bringing your knowledge and expertise to this show.
Yeah, it's
thanks
my
for
pleasure.
Having me.
Yeah. Issam is not the only Egyptian in the studio today. We have in the house my husband's and my exchange student, 17-year-old Nadia Abdel Azim, attending Nevada High School this year, who is training to become a show engineer. I think she's going to remain quiet today, but she and I have been conducting interviews to explore the Egyptian community here in Ames and see what it's all about. As you can imagine, most of the Egyptians in Ames are associated with the university, and I have, and also their children are attending a preschool that Emma's mother teaches. So we first spoke with Noor Abdel Samad, a PhD candidate in plant pathology, who lives here with his wife Hend and two daughters, age 2 and 5, and you can definitely hear them in the background.
So how did you know about Iowa to come here? Yeah, that's a good story. Before coming here, I went to Memphis, Tennessee, to stay with my brother. He's a PhD student there. At that time, I have no plans, so I just came in and I would like to get a job and build up my life and start making money to invite my family and spend some time here. Then somebody at University of Tennessee told me that if your major is agriculture, you have to go to some place like Iowa or UC Davis or something like that. These universities are famous in agriculture. So I get the chance and I went here. I spent about 2 weeks in a workshop, try to contact people around the campus, just knock the door and tell them that I'm interested in your work and I have, this is my experience and I would like to join the graduate school. And from that time, some of them replied by promising me good opportunities. Then I pick one of them and I continue my PhD from that time. But at the beginning, I start as a technician until I finish the university requirements and all of this stuff. Then I started as a master student. And during my master's, I transferred to PhD. And hopefully, I will be done by next May.
And have you connected with other Egyptian people and families here in Ames?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you join a new community, I search and look for Egyptian community and start sending them email back and forth. And they mention, yeah, you're welcome. And there is an Egyptian association here at Iowa State. And I contact them and they reply to me. So, and they mentioned, don't worry about anything, just came and we will take care of housing and take care of everything. So, they are very helpful and, I mean, I didn't feel that I am in a strange country. I mean, when I came here, the community is really good. Also, the Arabian community, not only the Egyptian community, we are, all of us are stays together and try to solve a problem for everybody. I mean, it was really a fantastic community, and I like it very much.
How do you get together? Do you have parties? Do you all go to the mosque? How do you congregate?
We usually go together and spend some time. And at the weekend, maybe we go outside and have some barbecue parties. And definitely we gather at the mosque on Friday and...
And are there other Egyptian students with young families like yourself?
Yeah, definitely. The students, when they came at the beginning, they either came alone and leave their family back in Egypt. And after a few months, they bring them back. Most of them have one or two kids or something like that. So it's really nice for the kids to play together and enjoy spending time. Especially for a PhD student, you know, the time is very stressful, you know. You have coursework and you have lab work, and you need to finish your PhD and you have time limited. So we bring ourselves together and we try to relieve the stress from each other by spending time at the house of each other and so on.
And are there any older people that you associate with?
Yeah, definitely there are old school in here. I mean, there are two faculty professors in Iowa State University in the engineering department, and they are really very nice. They help us and give us their experience, and they share the experience together. And actually, the Egyptian Association, the advisor of the Egyptian Association was Dr. Ayman Fayed. And right now he relocated to Ohio State University. So he was really nice, and you know, he always gave us advice on how to stay here and how to balance your social and your research life and everything. And also Dr. Ahmed Kamal, he's in Faculty of Engineering also, and he is very nice. He's very nice, give us advice and share his experience also with us. And we are very happy that we have those people in here. So sometimes when you don't have, when you face a problem, those are the first people that you knock out the door and talk to them, and they share the experience with us.
That was Noor Abdel Samad, a PhD candidate in plant pathology, talking about the Egyptian community in Ames. We then spoke with Dr. Ayan Fayed, the electrical engineering professor who has been the advisor of the Egyptian Student Association and who is now on a one-year appointment at Ohio State, his own alma mater, as a graduate student. Dr. Fayed said there were about 6 Egyptian faculty members permanently residing in Ames with their families, along with, on average, 10 graduate students and their families. I asked him what part of the transition from Egypt to Ames is the most difficult.
So I would say, I mean, Ames is a very special case because it's a much smaller town. So students typically are able to settle and take care of all the logistics a lot easier and a lot faster than, let's say, if they come to Columbus, Ohio, or Dallas, Texas, or any of the other big places, which is usually very overwhelming. I would say that most people initially struggle with the cold. You know, Egypt is not a cold place, as you can imagine. It's pretty warm. When students come in, they typically come in around July, August time frame. And once the winter hit, typically they struggle to adapt to that kind of weather, having the right clothes, you know, knowing what to do in a storm. That sort of stuff, I think, many students struggle with initially when they come to Ames. So I would say that the weather is the biggest challenge.
And the spouses of the students, how do they usually fare when they come over?
Well, believe it or not, they are actually usually very happy. I mean, the ones that I have met with and the ones that I have seen, they usually are pretty happy because, as I mentioned, there usually are several students. They also come with their spouses. They become friends. They hang out together. They go to the mall. I mean, there are plenty of things for them to do. And I would say that if you compare the lifestyle in Ames versus Egypt, for example, it tends to be a lot easier to do stuff here in Ames than in Egypt. So for them, typically, all the logistics and things related to how to sustain a house and all that are actually a lot easier to deal with in the United States than in Egypt. So most of the time, they're usually pretty happy.
That's good to hear. When Egyptian students graduate with a PhD or a master's from Iowa State, do they typically go back home to Egypt to, you know, use their skills, or do they find other work in the United States?
Okay, so in my experience, in many universities, not only Iowa State, and in most universities, most places, most people that I have seen, I would say that 99% of the graduate students, after they graduate from the university in the United States, they try everything they can to stay in the United States. I would say 99% of the cases, graduate students, after they're finished, they try their best to find internships or permanent positions in the United States so that they don't go back.
My goodness, that sounds like a brain drain from the perspective of
Egypt. It is a brain drain, but I have to report to you the facts, right? I mean,
yeah.
So the fact of the matter is that, yes, usually they don't go back. And is it a brain drain? The answer is yes, it is a brain drain. They're the cream of the crop anyway. The fact that they were able to make it to the United States, that means they're pretty good. So it's a sad fact that they don't go back. However, after several years of being in the United States, they obtain a job, they gain a lot of experience, they learn a lot of things beyond graduate school, and they do very well, they become very successful. Many of them later in life, they decide to go back.
No.
So, you know, after grad school, they may stay 10 years, 15 years, and then after that, they decide to go back, typically when the kids grow older. So once you start having kids in the teenage years or whatever, there are cultural concerns, if you will, that many Egyptians do have. It doesn't include me, but many Egyptians do. Kind of say, oh, you know, the kids are in a critical age right now, we would rather go and have them in Egypt and so forth and so on. So many of them end up going back later in life, and when they do, they start contributing to things over there. So it's not as bad, but reality is the number of people who end up going back later in life, I would say, is less than 10% of the total number of people who actually continue to live in the United States. Just one comment regarding the mechanism of people staying versus going back. I just wanted to highlight that the reaction of the Egyptian community in terms of, you know, people coming here and staying here, I think it's not uncommon that other communities behave the same way, and then it's always interesting to see how the mechanism changes over time. If you go back maybe 25 years ago, and you look at the Indian community, for example, people who come from India to pursue graduate studies here in the U.S., the same story was valid. 99% of them, they try to stay in the United States and they never go back. But if you look at the behavior today for students from India, students from Taiwan, from Korea, it's actually interesting that mostly students now, they finish and they immediately go back to India. They don't stay in the United States anymore, or at least the percentage is a lot smaller than it used to. And the reason that happens is that when you look at India, you look at Korea, they have done very well economically in terms of the job opportunities. So Indian students, they come here, they finish their PhD, and now they have degree from the United States. The offers that they get for jobs in high-tech companies in India are very lucrative, that many of them decide to simply go back to India. And Egypt is not yet at that point, unfortunately. It may take, you know, a decade or two in order for you to see an improvement that will change the mechanism of the number of people who would choose to stay in the United States versus finishing their education and going back.
That's very interesting. It's like the countries kind of get to a point where they're accelerating very quickly in their development, and that's when it's much more lucrative to go back.
And yeah, which is an interesting feedback loop if you think about it, because in order for them to start doing very well, they need the people who were educated in the United States to come back. They don't come back until the country accelerates. So it's very difficult to get into a position like India and Korea have gotten into, but it just takes a long time.
Well, thank you so much for your insights, and we hope to meet you sometime.
Yeah. I'll let you know when I'm named. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Nadia.
You're welcome.
Yeah, great talking to you.
Thank you.
Big house, bigger than they really need it. Got the dualies on his pickup. When the dealer gave him a choice, then he lost his job on the build site. Now he's struggling to feed his boys. And the red cedar grows, and the red cedar flows, and long after you're gone, it's outlasting you.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, together with my guest co-host for the day, Emma Wilson, a native of Nevada, Iowa, who is studying broadcast journalism at Drake University.
You just heard some music by Charlie Parr, a musician from Austin, Minnesota, who was here just last weekend for the 5th annual Maximum Aims Music Festival, which went from Thursday to Sunday and was capped off by a show by Mumfords, an Iowa band with frontman Nate Longston, who is the founder of Maximum Aims.
And among that band is Paul Hertz, who is well known around here at KHOI. He does a lot of different things, and he is actually coming up after our show with Morning Masterpieces, but he taped all of the shows at the festival, and we'll be playing highlights of the performances and the performers' recordings on Thursday's Ready Aims Fire show from 2 to 4 p.m. So Thursday, 2 to 4, if you have some memories of the event that you want to relive, tune in to Paul Hertz's show and see if he can play what you want to hear.
One event from the festival took place this weekend at KHOI, and that was a poetry reading, and it gathered together three poetry groups here in Ames.
Yeah, and I attended this event and wanted to present a couple poems from it. We're running a little late, but what I think I'll do is give you a taste of a poem by Brett Brinkmeyer, who is another KHOI producer. He has a half-hour show, poetry show, Wednesdays at 8:30 called Firsthand Poetry, and I just wanted to hear this poem again after having heard it the first time, so that's part of the reason why I'm sharing it today. So this was part of the Maximum Aims Music Festival. Poetry was also welcome, and this is Brett Brinkmeyer.
This one's called Recursive Path. The direction in the converse of the previous direction, which does not overlap itself or retrace its own path, but moves along obliquely in a completely new way. It moves at times subtly, or like a blade of grass growing up out of the ground, slowly and meticulously filling its space in the next moment with each thought. Other times, like a forest, rippled and roiled by the currents of the air, as the wind moves in and between and through the branches, shaking the leaves, and as the leaves shake back against the wind, causing it to change, and causing it to swirl in a new way. The way that was invited with each breath of itself, the wind, into the forest. It moves like this. The sky is full of clouds, and it's not the clouds necessarily that make up that fullness, but they are a part of it. And as the whole sky moves along with whatever it is that holds the sky, whether that's the earth or whether that's the space outside of the sky pressing down on it and its cool fluidity, it's like a stream that flows at different temperatures even within the larger body of water, and they're not really currents because they're not the same body. The temperature is different, the salinity is different, the density is different, the pressure is different. They are rivers at the bottom of the ocean.
And that was just a part of Brett Brinkmeyer's poem from Saturday's poetry reading at KHOI, part of the Maximum Aims Music Festival.
So this year at Maximum Aims, it actually coincided with probably the biggest annual sporting event here at in the state of Iowa, and that's the Hawkeye Cyclone game that this year was held at Jack Trace Stadium. And Greta, you were there for the tailgating party this year.
Yes, I was. I read that several presidential candidates were going to be there and visit the Story County GOP tent to speak. And in fact, only two candidates appeared and only one candidate spoke, Marco Rubio, and he was not willing to take questions. Here's me, the intrepid reporter, trying to chase him down to ask a follow-up question about a topic he had introduced in his 5-minute speech.
Question?
No, we're not taking,
you mentioned,
we're not taking questions right
you
now.
Mentioned
we're not taking
the
questions
economic
right now.
Policy.
We are not
okay.
taking any questions right now.
Yes, and all of the candidates were just surrounded by a very impenetrable bubble of handlers. I did get a question in to Rand Paul, however. Here's that exchange.
All right, do you have a question?
Yes, I have a question. We have the greatest income inequality in record, and studies have shown that other developed countries, people can climb the ladder much easier than they can in the United States, climb the economic ladder. What do you have to say about that? How is changing the tax code to a flat rate going to change that?
We're probably the richest nation in the history of mankind.
We're also the most humanitarian nation. In 2014 alone, private individuals gave away nearly $400 billion. The people who are poor in our society do struggle, but compare the poor of our society to the poor of any country, and I think you'll find that America has created an exceptional amount of wealth and has barely been a great place to live. Amongst all the places to live in the world, I wouldn't live anywhere but America. If you want to look at income inequality, it seems to be worse in cities run by Democrats and states run by Democrats. So if there is a...
Okay. So if my first pitch was a strike, that second was seriously a foul ball. He did not answer the question. I finally struck out by failing to capture any of the audio surrounding, or much of the very good audio surrounding my next guest and her cohorts. So I invited her here to our studio to share her experiences at the event. Maria Alcivar and a number of students showed up outside the Story County GOP tent with a large banner reading Students Against Bigotry. Maria, tell me how this group coalesced and decided to take this action.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. well, honestly, I read, as well as you did, on the newspaper that there was going to be some GOP candidates showing to the tailgate this Saturday. And I was waiting and anxiously waiting that Tuesday that the news came out about that event. I was waiting for someone to invite me to make a Facebook event about some type of demonstration happening. And I didn't get any for, 2 days. So then I was thinking, well, nobody's going to do anything about it, but yet we're here, a whole bunch of students. I have a whole bunch of students on Facebook, Iowa State students that always post things about, particularly Mr. Trump, videos on him, memes about him. And I'm like, well, if we're going to be doing this in social media, so why don't we actually do something when he's here right next to us, right? So I took it upon myself basically to email a whole bunch of student leaders, not only here from Iowa State, but from University of Iowa, from University of Northern Iowa, from Drake University, and from DeMatt College. So I emailed them, and then I emailed a few community members that I know out of Marshalltown and out of Des Moines. And I did that Thursday night. And then Friday morning when I came to my office in school, I had, more than 10 emails on responses of what are we going to do. So that's how it basically took place, or how it started.
Okay, and your group carried a number of signs besides Students Against Bigotry. The one that gained the most attention, I think, was one that said, a vote for Trump is a vote for white supremacy. And at the event, you were harassed. I witnessed quite a bit of harassment, and a lot of it was about that sign. They wanted you to explain it, and it being such a hostile environment, you were instructing everyone to just not respond to the taunts. But perhaps now, in a friendlier environment, you can talk about what that sign meant and why you were there.
Yeah, actually, the gentleman and a few other students that were with him were passing. I think they were just passing by, and they just joined us. You can see the difference in their sign. It was a cardboard box that they picked up, and they just wrote whatever they wanted to write, however they felt. So, I mean, I wouldn't be the proper person to ask as to why that sign was there, because I didn't. That wasn't one of my signs that I created. But hey, that's what he felt, and that's how he feels. He has all the right to express himself. And that's the way to do it, especially at a tailgate when you know there's people drinking and there's a lot of, hostile feelings towards our views. The only way to express it is writing it out and not saying a thing. Because if you engage in a conversation with somebody, especially somebody that doesn't have an open mind and is drinking, you might be starting, something a little bit more difficult to get out of. So.
Mm-hmm. So this was largely a Hispanic group of students.
No, it was not a large Hispanic group. Actually, we had a lot of Pacific Islanders there. We had a lot of white students there. We had a lot of black students there that came to support us. It wasn't a Latino Iowa State movement. It was a student-led demonstration, and I made sure that that was the tone, because we are not just complaining about the insults towards the Latino community. We're complaining about the insults in general, about women, about war veterans, about everything, immigrants. And immigrants are not only Latinos. You know, we fail to recognize that all the time. And at this point, in politics, we need to be a little bit more accurate, you know, and be more logical about the things that come out of our mouths, especially as politicians.
So we talk a lot in the media about reacting to Trump and how much attention we should be giving him. Were you afraid at all by drawing attention to Trump's actions that you're just kind of feeding the media fire and just adding more to his notoriety and successes in that way?
You know, I get a lot of that, especially when it comes to, like, posting things about Trump. And I try to stay away from that, but some of the things are just so great, that things that have come out basically bringing down all his myths that he's been throwing out there about immigrants and about the immigrant community. So I like to share those informational videos. But, no, I honestly think that there's been a lot of talk online about, you know, being activists and, you know, being a social activist. Well, I feel like part of being a social activist online has to show when we have the opportunity to demonstrate, you know, peacefully when politicians are around our area. And I think this is actually encouraging students from all races, from all ethnicities, from all over the world, you know, that have come here and that are immigrants, to stand up and say, hey, we're here. And our numbers basically are our strength. And I can say that that's how I feel about Saturday.
Right. And I can testify that that there were students who were educating. Like, I stood next to a guy who was trying to explain to his peers, and he was not really a part of your movement. He was not opposed to it. He was just kind of standing there trying to explain what your message was to others. And I saw this education going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that although there were some ugly encounters, there was a lot of education going on as well.
Oh, for sure. And that was another thing that I wanted to point out. There's a lot of negative things happening right now online because of that Saturday protest. But we did have a lot of people that came to us and said, good job. Good job for being here. You know, you could have been tailgating. You could have been at the game. You could have been enjoying yourself a beer. But you're here, you know, demonstrating peacefully. And you're doing it, you're doing it the right way. And congratulations. So they offered me water. They gave me hugs. You know, so it wasn't all negative.
Okay. And we have just a tiny little clip from that. Well, this is one of the sillier ones. Okay. Well, but it also has a little bit.
I'm voting for Trump. Does that make me racist? I'm brown.
Yeah, answer that question. Answer his question.
Go interview him.
Excuse me, sir, you want to be interviewed about your presidential preferences?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're supporting Trump.
No, not at all. I'm just trolling people. I'm drunk. I love trolling people.
There you go. So you saw kind of the whole range of craziness. But Maria, you and some of the other folks who were part of this protest are going to be on a show on KHOI later today.
That's
at 10 o'clock. Pan Dulce.
Yes.
Our own Jasmine Murguia, who used to host Local Talk, now has her own show with Veronese. And you are going to be talking about this at greater length. So if you're interested, folks, tune in at 10 p.m. tonight, KHOI 89.1 FM. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We started out hearing from Issam Boré, an Egyptian human rights activist involved in the Arab Spring revolution in 2011, who is now living in central Iowa. We then heard from Noor Abdel-Samad and Dr. Ayam Fayed of Iowa State University about the local Egyptian community. A poem by Brett Brinkmeyer was featured in our Maximum Aims wrap-up, and our final guest was Maria Alcivar from the student group that called itself for that day, or maybe for longer, Students Against Bigotry. Thank you so much, Maria, for being here.
Thank you for having me, Greta. I appreciate it.
We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Emma Wilson. Jonah DeGeest engineered the show. Paul Hertz and Brett Brinkmeyer helped with the show. Jennifer Wilson also helped line up the guests. And Nadia Abdelaziz helped me with interviewing them.
This show and all past local talk shows are available on our website, khoyfm.org, along with resource contact information. That's khoyfm.org. Local Talk airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as show. If you'd like to join our team and learn more about radio, contact us here at 292-278. As always, your participation as an audience is what makes our work worthwhile. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.